First meeting of the House Revenue Committee for the interim, the 99-2000 interim. We have a rather large interim revenue committee. Not everyone is here, but as you can see, we're expanded from our regular session membership. And I just want to welcome you all, and I think we've got a great lineup, and happy to have you all with us now, those of you who are returning revenue members and those of you who are also first-timers. I love you on the panel. So, delighted to have you with us. First thing we need to do is adopt the rules for the committee. You'll find those behind the agenda in your packet. You can take a minute to read over them. They're standard interim committee, standing committee rules. Nothing sneaky in there, is there, Paul? No. Yes, Representative Shetterly.
I'll move approval of the adoption of the committee rules.
Representative Shetterly moves that the committee rules be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objected? Any objection? Rules are adopted. Thank you. You also have in your packet, and you received in the mail, a copy of a work plan, and this, I believe, looks rather ambitious when you take a look at all these topics and when you realize that we spent almost 7 months in the Revenue Committee meeting every day of the week last year and didn't even get to all these topics. I don't think we're going to be able to exhaust discussion on these during the interim, but Paul will. He'll take care of them all for it. No, we did have this relatively long list of issues that we thought we needed to at least have some discussion about and some high-level briefings on during the interim in preparation for the upcoming session. Sort of my philosophy of the use of the interim, that its time is best spent in educating members and bringing them up to speed on issues in general, from sort of a global view, rather than working on specific legislation, since we have so much turnover now and it's uncertain who will be on the committee in the future, but I hope that there will be some continuity, and the more that you have some background on these issues, the more effective I think you'll be during the actual meeting of the session. So you see the list there. Tobacco revenue is one that we will talk about today a little bit later. We have a person who's visiting with us from San Francisco, a principal with Morgan Stanley, who is an expert in the tobacco settlement, and he's scheduled to be here at 9:45. So that should be an interesting time. The other issues, corporate income tax, local option for schools, which was, as you know, was successfully used by Corvallis. Taxes and economic development, the relationship between those two. The spending limit, which we spent no time on in the Revenue Committee last session, and revenue sharing with local governments, another topic that we didn't spend much time on. Intangibles, property taxation, which we did spend a lot of time on and which is back in our laps again. Workers' comp, and I'll have a little more to say about that in a minute, and initiatives on the November 2000 ballot. And, of course, we don't know what all those will be yet, but there are a great number of ballot or initiatives that have been filed and the ballot titles that are being shopped right now that may end up on the ballot and could have a substantial impact on the revenue picture for the next session. Regarding one of the things that's not on here, which is nice, is the timber taxation. We finally got that off our backs, and I want to thank all the members of the committee who worked on that last time, Representative Shetterly especially. On workers' compensation, I've had several conversations back and forth about what that topic is doing in our committee, since it's not normally something that that relates to the revenue side. It's usually handled in labor committees. But what I understand is that there's interest on the part of leadership in having a work group take a look at the marketplace for workers' comp, not talking about the kinds of benefits and what are covered services and whether injured workers are getting the appropriate treatment and so forth, but really taking a more global look at the players in the market and this the marketplace itself in terms of competitive parity between the carriers. And but we've had a few personal matters intercede in the and the Speaker's office. The Speaker's stepmother passed away, and then there was a staff change with J.L. Wilson leaving and Harry Wilhelms transitioning in. And so due to all those reasons, I haven't had the opportunity to sit down with the Speaker and the Senate President or the Senate Majority Leader and map out exactly what kind of a charge we want to make to this subcommittee of the Revenue Committee that will take a look at this issue. So therefore, I will not be able to appoint a subcommittee today, but it's my expectation that I will be able to meet with them in the next few weeks and probably make that appointment prior to the next meeting of the committee. So we'll just do it by letter and make sure that that's well publicized so that you all have a chance to take a look at it. I was hoping to be able to do that today, but circumstances have intervened so that we will not be able to do that. And we do have a number of members on this committee who are interested in that issue and will be appointed to a subcommittee. Are there any questions about that?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
The comment, I think perhaps people get somewhat nervous when they see the topic of workers' compensation on the agenda of the Revenue Committee because the safe funds have sometimes been seen as a source of revenue, or at least once notably, so I assume that we're not looking at that as a possible funding source for anything, and just to clarify that we're really looking at the marketplace issue is helpful.
Well, I don't think that that issue would be entirely ruled out, as I understand it. I think there's some, there's a 97 report that was done on the, was it 97, Paul? On the workers' compensation system, and that's being pulled off the shelf and revisited again. And in light of legislation that occurred that might change the usability of some of those funds that SAFE has, I think is another issue that this committee will be taking a look at. I share your concern. It's something that I've expressed a number of times, that I'm not comfortable just going in and assuming that the legislature can use safe money because of our hand-slapping experience that we've had to pay back during the last couple of sessions, hundreds of millions of dollars, which has impacted our ability to spend those dollars. But I do think that we should take a look at whether that is still a valid concern in light of how legislation has changed and what the statutory situation is today.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay. Well, I think that kind of covers my direction as well. And as I said, I think the, in my opinion, the interim is best used as a time for members to delve into some issues on sort of a investigatory basis and ask questions about things that that you are curious about. And as you can see on today's agenda, we'll be talking about some school finance issues. We'll have a review of the major revenue legislation that was passed. And a report, as you see in the work plan, there were several updates and reports that we'll be getting over the course of the interim. There's a committee on school finance, which I'm chairing also, that is scheduled to have a meeting in January, and we'll be talking at that point about the weights and the distribution of revenues for schools, K-12 schools. We also have a work group set up that's looking at a couple of property tax-related issues, especially urban renewal and the treatment of personal property in agriculture and small forest lands. We also funded, as you recall, a tax incidence study, and Representative Witt is a member. Are you chair of that committee?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
The chairman of that group, and you've already had one meeting, and maybe we can get an update on that a little bit later. In fact, we do have that scheduled for this morning, and then we also will be taking a look at some of the other tax laws that are scheduled to sunset and invite your introduction of bills at the end of the session that could be ready for the beginning of the 2001 session. Okay, any questions so far? With that, I think I will ask Paul to go ahead and get started with a review of major revenue legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, returning members, welcome back. I did notice on the work plan I'd sent out to you that I had property taxation of intangibles on there twice, and that wasn't an accident. That was just, I know it seems like Groundhog Day for those of you who have dealt with that issue, and we do have that scheduled later. The our next meeting the major issues we were looking for were corporate income taxation and local option for schools. So if there are some things you want us to look at before the next meeting, then be sure and pass that on to us. What I have in front of you today, and I'd like to go ahead and use the screen and projector. Mr. Chair, we've prepared really two main areas for a session review, and the first is a very broad overview, and I've got some material there that really is designed to give you a sense of context and how our public finance system is changing, and to hopefully give you some forewarning on some of the issues that will come up throughout the interim and into the next session. And then Steve Meyer will get into some of the details of the school finance issues, give you a chance to kind of revisit the bills that passed last session, and then to lay out some of the issues that were left unfinished that will result from those bills. Warm up my screen here for a minute.
Hasn't been used for a while, huh?
No.
Warm up.
It's in a Y2K.
It is Y2K compatible, so I have mixed feelings about using this because it's so elaborate to set it up when you take it somewhere. You feel like you're carrying about 100 pounds of equipment.
Light bulb.
We've got to get this in the proper sequence. I will point out we do have our revenue measures summary is in your packet, and that has some of the major bills, or at least from our standpoint, things we think will have long-term implications at the beginning, and then a very detailed a summary of all of the bills that had revenue implications. Most of them came through the Revenue Committee. A number of them had revenue impacts, and we have all of that material in that packet.
Nobody uses that in the next 2 years. Let it die.
Okay. Now it's blurry.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
I am. Mercy and I have a screen next one.
Okay, there we go.
Hey.
The package of overheads, Mr. Chair, are in front of you, so you can follow those along. First thing, just to, as a reminder for you, I know you are familiar with and thought about are the factors that are going to shape your policy decisions. I would make the case that the 1990s in particular have been a time of very strong economic growth, especially the mid-90s. We're now in a period where we're seeing a lot weaker growth. Oregon's job growth, for example, has dropped below the national average. The economy appears to be softening somewhat. There isn't any real obvious danger of recession at this point, but the period of very rapid growth appears to be over. We do have an update from the December economic and revenue forecast coming this afternoon, and that'll give you a sense about what the revenue projections look like. But certainly the economics of the 90s have been a huge advantage in terms of state policy. They've reduced the kind of the demand pressures for needs, and they've also generated a lot of revenue, a lot more revenue really than was anticipated. The demographics, one of the key issues in terms of the budget especially is the school-age population and school enrollment. Those numbers seems to be flattening out after very strong growth in the 90s. I did want to mention that there is an executive order that the governor has issued which establishes a school revenue forecasting committee. Which will look at things like enrollment, local school revenues, such as property tax revenue, things that have been looked at and done on an informal basis in the past. The governor's proposing to do that on a more formalized basis and has asked for membership from the Legislative Revenue Office to participate in that. The third and what in many cases has been the most dominant factor in terms of your decision-making has been the initiative. And you know, of course, the Measure 5 in 1990, then Measure 47 and 50 in 1997 have had a huge impact and dominated really two or three sessions during the 90s. And given the list of initiatives we see now that have been filed, that very potentially could be the case in 01 as well, where you get one major issue that shapes the entire session. When I was a state economist in the 1990s, we had a graph showing high-tech employment and timber employment. And it showed high-tech employment exceeding timber employment about 1995. And while that's obviously a simplification, it really seemed to resonate with people in showing how the economy had changed. Well, I would make the case that this graph shows very clearly how Oregon's revenue system has changed in the 90s. Prior to 1994, property taxes were the largest source of revenue, larger than personal income taxes. We had a decentralized revenue system. If you compared us with other states, our revenue came disproportionately more to local governments and less to state governments. Well, that changed dramatically in the 90s, and I think this is the legacy of the 90s in terms of public finance and shaping the decisions that you'll be making. Of course, the reason for that was Measure 5. And you can see that while Measure 5 may not have generated all the property tax relief that some individuals expected, it did cause about a 12% reduction in actual property tax collections from 1990 to 1996. At the same time that was happening, the personal income tax And this has kicker refunds in it. So the personal income tax growing very rapidly, really without the kicker refunds in the neighborhood of 10% annually during a period when inflation is running 2 to 3%. So really unprecedented in terms of the income tax growth. The projections there, again, we'll get to those later, but...
Excuse me, Paul, Representative Rosenbaum.
Just a question, Paul, before you leave this slide. Does the line that represents property taxes represent both business and residential property?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum, that is all property tax collections. So there has been some definite shift in the shares there, whereas the residential share has risen, and in that 12% reduction I mentioned, most of that was on the non-residential side, commercial and industrial. And, of course, the reason for that is the the trends in terms of market values have been quite different, with residential property growing much faster in value. That, by the way, also appears to be slowing pretty significantly, that we're not seeing those kinds of residential property increases. In terms of the projection there on the property tax, that's about a 5% growth per year. And we're thinking that kind of the rule of thumb is, well, there's 3% and from the value growth limited by Measure 50, and then 2% from new construction through the exception value. The income tax growth there is about 6% a year. But if you look at the risks out there, the income tax risk, I think, are considerably more, particularly when you realize the amount of capital gains that have been generated in recent years and the income tax revenue associated with that, which last year was roughly $400 million, a 37% increase in the 97 returns from the 96 returns. So that's directly a product of the strong stock market.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Warner. Paul, after the passage of Measure 13, Prop 13 in California, they had quite a similar situation occur, but I don't believe that their property taxes after just a few years, and it looks like because of the phase-in of Measure 5, we have the downward trend, but it was just a few years that it slowed, and then it increased substantially because of the new building. Can we ascribe any of the personal income tax growth to the Measure 5? Is there any nexus between the two?
Representative Butler, I think you can make the argument, and certainly it is made, that what the property tax did was reduce the cost of capital. And with a lower cost of capital, you would expect more investment, particularly by capital-intensive industries. And, you can never go back and really isolate it completely to that effect. I will point out, though, that one of the key drivers in all of this, of course, was the high-tech semiconductor investment. And those companies also received further property tax incentives. For example, in the case of Hyundai, they were under the enterprise zone. For Intel, it was under the strategic investments program. So there were some other inducements as well, but you could certainly make the case that Measure 5 reduced the cost of capital, and that had a positive effect on investment.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Of course, the result of this and the legacy that you wrestled with for a good part of the 99 session and will into the future is that it has shifted the funding for schools and centralized it, basically shifting from a system in which the state was producing 30% of the revenue to one now in which it's producing 70% of the revenue. And keep in mind, and Steve will go through the details with you, that the package that was passed last time was roughly about two-thirds of the total school revenues. That schools are still getting a significant, though much reduced, chunk of revenue from their local sources. So this is an area we are tracking quite closely, and we will, if we see evidence that the local revenues are coming in under projections, this can put the school budget into jeopardy as well, and we'll keep you posted on that as the data comes in. The other side of this, I've been kind of working with this chart, and now I've tried the donut approach here, the donut theme today. And this is, of course, a reality that I'm sure you're aware of, is that now the K-12 and community college budget takes up about 50% of your total general fund budget, roughly a doubling its share from 10 years ago. Again, that's the legacy there. Public safety has grown a little bit, primarily because of Measure 11. Higher ed has shrunk significantly. DHR slash DHS now has dropped slightly. The other largely resource agencies have dropped from 23% down to 6%. So they've basically been taken off the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Paul, going back, before we get too far down the road, on the property tax, I'm wondering if you've done any charts that show the $15 per thousand five goes to schools and 10 to local governments. If you were to shift that, that was some sort of an arbitrary formula, as I understand it, in Measure 5. If voters were to approve a change, keeping the $15 cap but shifting within, do you have any analysis of how much each percent change would add to local school funding and reduce local government funding? And is there, I assume that's easy to get.
Representative Becker, and actually there was some interest in that last session. Particularly, we had some people on the Senate side that were interested in that issue. We do have, we can generate something on that. I'd be happy to do that. I'll give you some quick summary numbers on it. Of course, it would require constitutional change.
Sure.
But it's something that would be relatively easy to do in terms of the revenue generated. Now, under Measure 50, of course, the schools have dropped considerably below the $5, and they're getting closer to $4 in terms of an effective tax rate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that I've been able to do in my spare time in the interim is to try to take a little bit more in-depth look at overall revenue, and I think the best source to do this, although there are some flaws in it, but the best source to do this is the census data that comes out on an annual basis of all state and local government revenue. The drawback is that it's a delayed, and when it comes out, the latest we have is 95-96. But I think what this chart does is allow you to sit back and look at how the system responded to Measure 5. Measure 5 passed in 1990, and this 95-96 was the last year of the phase-in of Measure 5. So we have the maximum effects of Measure 5 in terms of the full rate reductions. And if you look at how the revenue mix changed over that period, first of all, in terms of general revenue, and this is census definition of general revenue, which is everything except trust funds. So it's everything except PERS, unemployment comp, those kinds of trust funds. So it's very broad. And notice that if you look at general revenue as a percentage of income, it increased over that period. About very slightly, it increased from 22.2% to 23.6. So there was actually a slight increase in general revenue as a share of total income, which is roughly in line with what happened nationally over that period in terms of general revenue. So Measure 5 did not prevent that trend from occurring that was consistent with other states. What it did do, however, was lower the tax burden pretty significantly. Our taxes as a share of income went from 12% to 10.7%, which dropped Oregon from 13th in the country to 37th. So it did have a significant effect on the tax burden during that period.
Excuse me, say that again,
from 13th to 37th in terms of ranking, Mr. Chair, and on the in terms of percent of income from 12% down to 10.7%. So what that's saying is that there were other non-tax sources of revenue that emerged to fill that gap. And those are three listed right there, the three major categories of the census definitions. The first is federal revenue, which grew very rapidly at this time and did indeed for most states. But you can see that rose as a percentage of income. Charges, which are anything from tuition, for example, charges for local services. It can be fees for the park system. So charges rose significantly during this period. And keep in mind, this is all as a percent of income. So these were growing faster than Oregon's rapidly growing income in the period. And charges rose from 3% of income to 4%. So you lost 1.3 on taxes and as a percent of income. Charges rose 1%. There is a close correlation there. The last category was miscellaneous, which is always my favorite category. But in the case of Oregon, it has one specific meaning that I'll get to in a minute. The miscellaneous revenue was a significant factor for Oregon, rising from 0.8% of income to 1.9%. Basically, what happened is the state substituted charges and miscellaneous revenue for taxes. and substituted non-tax revenue for tax. So now Oregon's revenue system is different than other states in the sense that if you look at taxes as a percent of general revenue, they're 45%. Nationally, they're 55%. So we're less reliant on taxes as a source of revenue than other states. The state dependence on single tax revenue, Oregon has a unique system in another sense, too, and that is that our tax system is very much centered on the personal income tax. And the genesis for this chart is these are state data only, so it's 97, 98, but the categories I had are personal income, corporate income, property, sales, excise, which would be individual sales like gas and cigarettes, and other. And I had those all in percentage terms by state, and I was looking at those percentages and seeing, well, who has the most revenue tied up in one source? And, of course, it was Oregon who came to the top with 68% of our tax revenue coming from the personal income. So we're more dependent on a single tax revenue source than any other state. Now, Alaska's second, and they're in the other category, but their other is oil and gas severance tax, predominantly what that category is. And, of course, they have very little other taxes, no income tax and sales tax. Washington, on the other hand, is in a similar situation, very dependent on the sales tax. Tennessee and Florida and a number of southern states are in the category too. Massachusetts is the other state that is approximates Oregon in dependence on the income tax. They're about 56%. But Oregon stands out in that regard. One thing I will say in terms of a kind of a long-term revenue viability standpoint, I'd rather be dependent on the personal income tax than the sales tax, given changes in technology and changes in what the internet might do, and those sales tax states may have some real serious revenue problems in terms of a slow erosion of their tax base. I mentioned miscellaneous revenue, and that explains the miscellaneous revenue, because miscellaneous revenue includes lottery. If you look at lottery revenue, again, this is 95-96, so it's really the peak of the lottery revenue growth period before it flattened out, but per $1,000 of income, Oregon received only over $10 in lottery. South Dakota was second at $7. Nobody else was above $4. So the state was about five times more dependent on lottery than the average state. So again, that's the other unique feature of our system is dependence on the personal income tax and our reliance on the lottery revenue.
Paul, is that your miscellaneous category back there?
Exactly, Mr. Chair. That's the miscellaneous category. And that's what jumped. The miscellaneous category during this period increased 256%. So, and that was the lottery growth. Now, that lottery number has come down because income has grown and lottery has pretty much flattened out. But I would make the case that if you look at our revenue system in terms of dependence on personal income tax, dependence on lottery, and then look at the initiatives that are being filed. What are they aimed at? Those are the major revenue sources. So you can see that gives you a sense of where their pressures are likely to come from.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Beck.
So does that say something about, is that a relative figure relative to other revenue sources, or is this just focused on the lottery per $1,000 of personal income? I guess that's what the chart says.
Representative Beck, that chart just looks at what are state revenue dollars collected per $1,000 of income. So it's about $10 per $1,000 of income, total personal income in the state.
So can you guess as to why we're generating, what does it say about our lottery system compared to other states that we're generating that much relative income out of lottery? I mean, what can we draw from that?
Representative Beck, it shows that we use video poker.
Other states don't. That's simple.
Some states have gone to it, and again, it's kind of the age of the data, they were 95, 96. We've seen some states go in that direction since then. South Dakota also has video poker, and that's why they're up there. So the answer is video poker. And video poker now is about 80% of lottery net revenue. So it's a lot different game than the traditional lottery games, and a lot more attractive to people. More people want to play.
Are other states now going to video poker? Or?
We've seen some states go to. We've seen some states start to back off a bit, like Louisiana.
Yeah. Could I ask you one other way? If we say, based on the state lottery percent of per $1,000 of personal income, and you also say that another way that Oregon residents spend a greater share of their income on lottery games than any other state?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that they spend a higher percentage of their income on state-sponsored games. But you cannot take that and say more on gaming, because remember, there are other types of gaming, like tribal gaming is not in here. That's a sovereign government that doesn't show up there. And, of course, Nevada, for example, just taxes their gaming industry in a lot different way. With the private sector, they take 6% of gross receipts, and that is their largest general fund revenue source. So they're actually more dependent on gaming, certainly, than Oregon is, but they tax it as, and that shows up in their sales taxes in dollars. Mr. Chair, packet on the major revenue summary. These were kind of the all-star list, and that struck us as really the measures that passed during the session that we think will have the most long-term implications for the system and for legislators in the future in terms of decisions. One thing I hate to tell you, though, if you take those first four, you're not done with any of them, because they all ultimately will be decided by the voters, either in the case of 2082 through a referendum in May, 2007 and Senate Bill 535 referred directly by the legislature to the November 2000 ballot. We'll talk some more about those as the November elections approach. And 2753, which, of course, ultimately will be decided by local voters. So those really are issues we will come back and revisit a number of times during the interim. The House Bill 2082, which, just to remind you some of the major elements of it here, we are working toward revenue estimates that will be for the referendum. We'll have those ready for you at the February meeting. So those should come out in about a month or so. The Joint Transportation Committee has asked us to have a new set of estimates for their January 20th meeting, so we're shooting for that as a deadline, and basically look at it in terms of a yes or a no vote on the referendum. The Health Security Fund, we'll talk about this today. The tobacco settlement revenue, which of course is the source of this. And I did want to point out a couple of things before we get to some of our invited testimony, is that this growth in terms of the settlement principal, which was projected to be the principal to grow about $1.5 billion over this period, there are some issues to keep in mind that affect that growth. We're already seeing them come into play a bit. One is the so-called volume adjustment, which this revenue is based on the shipment of cigarettes. Total shipments. So if you've got less demand out there, less people smoking, in other words, and buying cigarettes, then you will see less shipments, therefore less of this revenue coming in. And it looks to me, looking at these projections done during the session, that we're going to be down about $5 million a year or so. Just what we've seen the first year, 1999, it looked like shipments were down about 10%. So we are seeing less revenue there, and our invited testimony can address some of those issues as to what the risks are and what the level of certainty is in terms of looking at this as a revenue source.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, Paul, in like manner, when we've got a reduction in the overall master tobacco settlement, the 1+% which the state of Oregon is due to receive, we also, does this take into, this wouldn't take into consideration the reduction of our revenues that we'll be receiving as a state from the stamp tax on that same tobacco product, does it? This is just from a master tax settlement, master tobacco settlement.
Yes, Representative Butler, that's a very good point, and I've asked Dick Yates to look at that a little bit. He's got some, he'll go over some of our current projections, because we are in a situation where we are relatively dependent on cigarette tax revenue. It's 68 cents a pack, and I did put in those excise tax rates in your packet that we mailed to you, and say we're 10th in the country in terms of cigarette tax rates, and we do have some programs that are growing relatively rapidly, particularly Oregon Health Plan, that are dependent on a revenue source that is not growing rapidly. So you have some potential mismatch there between demand and the revenue stream. So, you know, in terms of the settlement itself, the pricing strategy of the tobacco companies will be very important in that, in determining just what happens to shipment. Obviously, the higher the increased prices, we may think people smoke no matter what, but they will smoke less. The higher prices, that's proven. We know that's the case. So the higher the price goes up, the less we're going to get in terms of shipments and therefore in terms of revenue. And of course, less in terms of cigarette tax revenue because it's a cent per pack base. Mr. Chair, this is Senate Bill 535, which increased the federal subtraction from $3,000 to $5,000. And again, this is a significant piece of legislation in our view. One thing, it represents an effort to trim income tax rates. Again, I think this is something that you will see a number of proposals again in the 2001 session. And of course, a lot of it has to do with the dependence on the personal income tax. And the fact that personal income tax now is a percent of income in Oregon is second highest in the country. You see that as most tax reduction programs, proposals, many of them will be aimed at the income tax. And this is one that will go on the November ballot. And, of course, the other one that is similar but considerably bigger impact is the initiative filed by Bill Sizemore and Oregon Taxpayer United.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, just 2 points. One, this chart shows that the greatest percentage of tax relief under Senate Bill 535 is going to the 40 to 75,000 income category. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, Representative Witt.
A second point, and maybe you can clarify this, as it relates to corporate taxation of income in the state of Oregon, in corporations, do they get a deduction for federal taxes that they pay in determining what the tax that they owe to the state of Oregon?
Under current law, Representative Witt, they do not. Under the initiative filed by Oregon Taxpayers United, they do. And so there is two aspects of that measure. It's not a part of Senate Bill 535. Senate Bill 535 raised that deduction from $3,000 to $5,000.
Mr. Chairman. But under present law, corporations can't deduct any of their federal tax in determining the tax that they owe to the state.
That's correct.
Representative Patridge.
Paul, I didn't remember what the numbers were on 535. What was the revenue? What was the revenue? Do you have rough revenue impacts? Totals.
As our income tax expert, 2001, 2003 biennium is 158. The 03, 05 biennium is 248. So there's a phase in there. It's effective. It becomes effective in 2002, January 1, 2002. So that's why you get a smaller impact in the 01, 03 period.
And can you tell me also, or have you done any initial impacts on the Sizemore and Oregon Taxpayers United initiative?
Ed's been waiting for his cue. Representative Patridge, the impact on this, and we can make a copy of this for the committee, Mr. Chair, if you'd like us to, but the 9901 and the initiative is effective with the 2000 tax year. So it would be a 9901 revenue impact. We're estimating it $1,050,000, and 144 of that would be the corporate deduction. 906 of that is the personal income tax reduction. For 0103, the estimate is about $1.7
billion. Almost 17% of the state budget.
Mr. Chair.
Did you have another question? Representative Butler.
Paul, relative to that amount of taxation, the reduction, if the Sizemore initiative were to pass and it takes effect on January 2000, then the first tax returns under normal circumstances could be filed on a fiscal year by corporations and by certain individuals who file fiscally, but that really would not take effect until December 31st, 2000, for the majority of individuals. And that's why there is such a substantial effect during the current biennium, is because of the fact that that would go into effect and actually affect one full cycle and actually a half year in the current biennium, in addition to one full filing cycle. Do the numbers you reflect there actually take into consideration all 18 months then? Is that what we have? Because you'll have fiscal taxpayers.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Ed, why don't you come on then? What we would anticipate, I mean, obviously people aren't going to, or we wouldn't expect them to adjust their withhold during 2000 in anticipation of it passing in November, but we would anticipate that there would be very big refunds in 2001. So that would be in the last 6 months of the biennium is when that revenue impact would be concentrated. So.
Representative Butler, members of the committee, I really don't have much to add to that. The personal income tax estimate incorporates the phase-in fully. The corporate estimate is a little rougher, and we'll work on refining that. It's essentially 1 year's liability estimate.
So it doesn't include all 18 months then?
For the personal, it does. For the corporate, it's basically 12 months. Worth of revenue impact because of the uncertainty of when corporations choose to begin their tax year and how that would interact with the effective date of the initiative.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum, then, shall we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we had a fair amount of discussion of this during session, but I don't remember whether we saw a spread of all the states as far as what they do on federal tax deductibility. Is that information that you have available and that we could get? The reason I'm asking is I just came back from an NCSL meeting where there was a workshop on state tax systems, and it was really fascinating to see the range of how different states do this. I mean, it's all the way from, I mean, I don't remember the numbers, and I don't know if you have them in your head, but there's really a huge range.
Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I do not have those numbers in my head, but I do have a sheet that I can provide to the committee which shows how other states with income taxes treat federal income taxes. It's by no means a general rule that there's any deductibility at all. some states allow varying levels of deductibility. What it does essentially is it shrinks your tax base, and to compensate for that, states might have to have higher income tax rates than they would otherwise.
You can make a copy of that and send it to the members. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Your revenue impact, you said, takes into account refunds that would be due individuals in the first 6 months of 2001, I guess. Does it also take into account, I would imagine if the initiative, if the Sizemore initiative were to pass in November, we would see an immediate drop-off in the next estimated tax payments, either end of December or January, when people choose to pay those. Plus, in the, still within the biennium, you'd have tax estimated payments due in April and again in June. But does the revenue impact take the drop in estimated tax payments into account as well as the refunds?
Representative Shirley, yes, it does.
Okay.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the last slide I had was just House Bill 2753, and Steve will talk a little bit about that. He does, he has worked on a special research report for you to look at, and that will be one of our major topics for the February meeting. And as you know, the Corvallis District is already gone to the ballot and able to pass a local option, so we'll see if we can get them in to talk about that and give you a sense on how that process worked. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Steve to go into some school finance background.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue. You have the school finance handout, the 2 slides per page list that I'll be working from. You have something else scheduled for 9:45 if he's here.
All right.
Feel free to interrupt me.
All right. That,
and, since he has. At another time. Or
okay.
Not.
Yeah, that gentleman has an airplane to catch, so. Comedy.
You also have handed out to you, I believe, in your packet, research report number 4, which deals with the 99 legislation, and about everything that I want to comment on is in that report. You also have research report number 599, which deals with the local option tax for schools, and probably won't get to that, but you will come back to it, as Paul said, at your next meeting, probably. Okay, 1999 legislation. We're clicking right here. I want to talk about a little bit on funding to begin with, just to refresh your memory as to how that all turned out. And then primarily talk about ESD distribution, because that was the really new chunk of school finance legislation this last session, dealing with ESDs, and then just touch on K-12 distribution. Go back to the magic number of $4,811,000,000 and just look at the components of that for a moment. The state school fund, $4,577,000,000. The lottery-backed state bonds, $112,000,000 for the biennium. By the way, those bonds have been sold, so that money is in hand. The first distribution, I believe, as I understand it, will be in January of 2000, the first $56 million of that, first half. And that the second half then will probably be in July of 2000, so early in the second fiscal year. So that's set now. We don't have to be concerned about that. Senate Bill 622, the network technology funds $50 million. From what I saw in the paper, U.S. West has agreed to the regulatory conditions in Senate Bill 622, so I expect those funds to be available. The first $25 million could come in this fiscal year, and then not sure yet how the second $25 million payment, just when that will be made. But the timing of that is a little bit easy in terms of which if it's going to be soon enough to get in that second fiscal year in schools, Canada. At least that's I think it will work out, but there's a little bit of hesitation in that. The Common School Fund increase, $50 million.
Excuse me, Steve, if that doesn't make it in that in this biennium, that throws off the total amount that's going to schools this biennium, doesn't it?
Yes, it would. But I think that will be cleared up so that it does come in the right fiscal year. The Common School Fund increase... There's the state land board did change its policy in terms of what it would pay out on the earnings. The minimum is going to be 2%. The earnings for 1999 are such that there will be sufficient funds to meet the $25 million increase. So that's not in doubt. The second year, a little less certain as to what those earnings are going to be. whether their adopted policy would work to generate the full $25 million. But if it doesn't, there's still the possibility that they could make a supplemental distribution so that there would be the full $25 million in the second year. So I'm kind of expecting that to happen, even if the investment, the payment, the earnings aren't sufficient under their current policy to meet the full $25 million. Local revenue revisions, $18 million. This is a combination of two numbers. One, remember that we revised the local revenue estimate during the session, which generated, I think, $38.5 million more. But then at the very end of the session, remember, there were changes in the timber taxation and the privilege fees on private timber, and that reduced local revenue by $20.5 million, I believe. So this is the net of those two. It reduced local revenue, but it was offset by an increase in the state school fund. There wasn't any net change. And then the final component was the urban enhancement, $4 million for Portland. Okay. The state school fund, then, is made up of three sources, the general fund being the major portion, but there's also some lottery revenue that's in that state school fund, and then also a small amount of timber revenue that I just mentioned. That goes directly into the state school fund rather than going to the districts. The effect is the same once it's processed through the formula. But it was, the decision was made to go ahead and funnel it directly through the state school fund. But when we think of state school fund, we usually think of that revenue being there for certain. That's not the case with the timber revenue, and perhaps a little bit on the lottery side. So there is a little bit of uncertainty on that state school fund being what we thought it was at the end of the session. But that's just because of the funds that are a part of it now. Okay, how is all that money divided up? Just again to refresh your memory, on the state school fund and local revenue for ESDs, the ESDs themselves get about $150 million per year, and then the Oregon Public Education Network was also funded out of that at about $1.1 and $1.2 million per year. If you add those two together, you get the $150 and $151 million as a funding cap. Now, that is a new policy applied to ESDs. That last biennium, there was a funding cap on state school fund and local revenue, but it applied to the total, both K-12 and ESD. This time, that was split up so that there's a separate cap for ESDs from the cap that applies to K-12. So it's treating ESDs a little bit more like K-12, and K-12 doesn't gain or lose depending on what happens to ESD money like it did last biennium. If there's a drop in local revenue below what was estimated, ESDs will suffer from that just like K-12, rather than it all being on the K-12 side. Okay, the other change is that the ESDs have a set dollar amount out of the state school fund. Again, a change in policy. There was a specific dollar amount set aside for ESDs. Okay. On the K-12 portion, then you have just over $3 billion for distribution through the formula in 1999-2000 and about $3.2 in the second year of the biennium. The legislature continued to fund at $400,000 the payments to school districts that have special ed students that have to be placed out of state for their particular deal with their disability, or there isn't any space or room or an in-state program that they could attend. A change was made for special education billing. This was in House Bill 3365, that there are certain state programs like the hospital programs, long-term care programs, deaf and blind school, those kinds of special education costs for state programs that are billed back to the county school fund. And before, if there wasn't enough money in the county school fund, it was billed directly to the school district. This change says that if there isn't enough money in the county school fund, we'll take it out of the state school fund and not from the district. So that is makes it more fair, so that under the old system, if it was billed directly to the district, that was just less money for them. They didn't get more state dollars because of that billing. So by doing it this way, then each school district is treated the same way. The other thing about local revenue, as Paul mentioned, is that the governor, by executive order, set up this school revenue forecast committee. That's going to bring in more outside or more diverse input into that process of estimating what local revenues should be or might be during the interim. It's going to formalize the process. It's also going to require that be done for 3 years, not just for a biennium. And the idea is to give school districts a better idea of what they can expect for budgeting purposes over a longer period of time. So if they have programs they want to develop that they want to fund on an ongoing basis, this will give them a better idea of what that funding level might be.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
I really apologize that I started listening about halfway through that last sentence. What is the change that is going to allow school districts to have this information on a 3-year projection?
The school revenue forecast committee that the governor is setting up by executive order,
okay.
Right? Their charge is to do it for 3 years into the future. And that report is to come out at the same time in December when the economic and revenue forecast comes out before the beginning session. So that will be like projecting out a current service level for school district over that time period. Okay, the split between local and revenue for K-12s and ESDs is still about the same, 30% local, 70% state school fund, especially when you include the YCEP program, which comes out of the state school fund because they have no local revenue. The local portion is roughly $2 billion. The state school fund portion, the $4.577 billion. Okay, that's all I want to say about revenue. Assuming he is not here yet.
No,
okay,
he's not.
Then I'll continue. Next, I want to talk about education service district distribution in House Bill 2567. Just first touch on the revenue for education service districts. The local state school fund split is slightly different than the overall total. You can see there by the two bars that the state school fund portion is about 60% and local revenue about 40% of the ESD total. That varies a little bit from what it is for K-12. You also see a bar below the line. Two ESDs give some money to their component school districts. That gets picked up as local revenue on the K-12 formula side, so it's shown here as a decrease in education service district funds. And note also that the revenue here does not include contract service revenue that some ESDs have substantial amounts of. Now, what was new this session in this bill was the distribution for ESDs. Before, the old method was primarily to fund a percent of their Major 5 property tax losses. That information isn't available anymore. A different approach had to be taken. The decision was to, at least initially, for this biennium, and it's not a continuing, it's a temporary distribution for ESDs, is to make state and local revenue equal to the higher of two numbers. And one is a revenue per student times the number of students, or a total revenue number. That's the format, and then we'll see specifically how that's applied. For 1999-2000, I'll explain why I say initial allocation in a few minutes. The amount was a statutory revenue amount per student for a district times the number of students in that district. And I'll show you those statutory revenue numbers in a moment. That was to bring up the 9 ESDs that had the lowest amounts per student. And per student here is weighted student, and the students in the school districts that are the component school districts for that ESD. For those that aren't covered by the statutory list, then it's the high, for them it's the higher of their 98.99 revenue per student times their current year students, or the total dollars, state and local dollars, that they had in 1998-99. That dealt with the other 12. Here you have a list of those that come under the statutory revenue, the nine that were raised from two specific amounts compared to their 1998-99 amount the prior year. The decision basically was to, rather than raise all of the lowest to some number, to raise a, and that would have been about the lowest four or five, as I recall, to give some increase to the nine lowest. Right? So that's why you see the different amounts for these districts, varying from $125 at the lowest to $225 at the highest on a weighted per student basis.
And the statewide average is still where?
It's around 240, if I remember right.
That's what I was thinking, 245, something like that.
Okay, for 2001, you have the same situation, only you don't have a direct reference to the statutory table, because instead you have the reference to the 1999-2000 year, which includes the table numbers. So if a district, for example, at their amount in the table, say it was $200, if they had a drop in students for 2001, they would, the higher amount would be the B option, the total dollars in 9900, because of the drop in students. Therefore, they would have a higher dollar amount per student. In the second year, the amounts in the table may be the same. They may change, those nine districts, depending on what happens to their number of students. When you have a system like this, you have two things going on. You have this per student amount cost and total dollar cost added up, saying, well, this is what we expect ESDs to get. It isn't balanced to the revenue that's available, because the number of students are estimates. The number of